Just recently, when we had a brother who couldn't do the exhortation, Brother Stephen sent out an urgent appeal to all of those on the list. And I waited a while and then sent an email through saying, well, I would do it as a last resort. And he said, he replied by saying, oh, we already have a last resorter. So you're last resorter number two. So in the absence of Brother John this morning, I am your last resorter exhorter. It's actually a bit of a tongue twister if you wanted to say it five or six times quickly. In any case, if I had a title for what I'd like to share with you this morning, it would be The Sound of Silence. The Sound of Silence. And I'm going to add to that another little bit that would say The Beginning of Miracles. The Sound of Silence, The Beginning of Miracles. And of course, this is said against the background of the clamor of our lives. Now, I freely admit that I may only be talking to myself this morning. I suspect that's not true, and that much of what I'm going to say will apply to your lives as well. We have never lived in such a complex society that is so full of choices and so many opportunities. And it appears that because of our particular nature, the inherent nature that we have, that we feel that we must rise to those occasions as they present themselves, which makes for a very, very hectic life. There are some things that we consider to be sacred. For example, work. Now, that's a good Protestant thing, actually, and forgive me for saying that, but, you know, we've got chapter and verse that says if you don't work, you don't eat. And you're going to be good servants, so if you got five talents, you go out and make another five. So career and employment, we serve our masters as we would serve Christ. And so these are biblical concepts. Some of us are in business, and we have to be honest and show good fidelity in business. And, of course, you can't have a good career and good employment and a good business unless you have some education. So we've got to throw education into that mix. And if that's not enough, then many of us, when we reach a certain age, start to deal with managing a home. And if you've got a home, then there's some stuff there, too, because they deteriorate and they have to be maintained, and you have a garden. And the house probably has a family in it eventually, so then there's pressures of the family. And young parents have children who go to school, and then they have summer, the choices and the challenges of summer. And that's very quickly followed by back to school and all of the clamor and the noise that goes with that. We have an amazing number of choices available. And we could go on and on, and I don't wish to make this part of the exhortation as big as it could be, but you can throw in travel, for example, just basically running to and fro in the world. Electronics. Amazing challenges to us because of electronics. And, you know, I've said this before, but I can get email because people send me email for announcements. So this is good. Much of this is good. I can get my email before I get up to give the announcements. But, of course, that brings a whole bunch of other challenges into our life and all the things that we can do and hear and see. All the noise and clutter and chatter of our lives. And us human beings, we want them all. And we kind of want them all like there's no tomorrow. And I have this ability now and this blessing of being able to go back and look at my grandfather's and my grandmother's life of so many years ago, it seems, that where life was so simple. I mean, how many choices did my grandfather have? Very, very few. And many of these expectations are self-imposed. We think we need to do these things. We think we need to have this noise. We think that's what our life has to be. We're dealing with a client recently, just this last week, as a matter of fact, who was born in Port Sudan. He's a Sudanese. He's living in a million-dollar home in Broadmead and just spending $30,000 or $40,000 to upgrade his garden. But he was born in Port Sudan. He was born, he said, in a very middle-class neighborhood, and when he was a child, Port Sudan was kind of at the end of the British Empire where there was a a terminus for the railway that took all of the goods and services and products from the Nile River out to the Red Sea. So the Port Sudan was a pretty decent, prosperous place. And now many of his fellow countrymen in the south, not, when I say many, I say millions of his fellow countrymen in the south, would be content this morning with a glass of cold water. So we have to stop sometimes, brethren and sisters, and say, well, what are our basic needs? And what are the societal expectations? And what are the things we want because we have the choice and we can have them? And of course, oh, by the way, we have the ecclesia. Our neighbor, he hangs on his patio on Sunday. We go to the meeting twice. And the other meetings. And it's good. It's not to say that it's bad. It's just to ask the question, where is the silence? Where is the moment when there is no noise? I believe that we've probably almost lost that art of silence. That complete cessation of activity and noise. When we ever reach that state, and again, I'm just talking to myself maybe, but if we ever reach that state, we get anxious that we got nothing to do. We think something's wrong. We feel guilty and strange that we're not doing something. There isn't some sound or something. And we imagine somehow that we're missing out maybe on some of the choices of life. We often get nervous and agitated by silence in this chatty, busy, noisy world that we live in. But the scriptures are quite clear that there is no miracle that's going to happen in our life. Nor is there any way that the Lord will communicate with us or we can communicate with the Lord unless we shut up. Maybe I'm saying that a little harshly, but I think that's really the way it needs to be said. Let's go to Psalm 46 and verse 10. And we could probably find many verses. And then, of course, when I was making the announcements this morning, I realized that Brother Jack is lecturing this evening on finding peace, is it, in a stress-filled world. And I thought, I wonder how many of his verses I've got. But anyway, at least, Brother Jack, you'll have the advantage of knowing what I said, right? So, Psalm 46 and verse 10. Be still and know. Now, these words are very important, and you might find that I'm reading from the Revised Version. It says, be still, but it might say something like be at rest or a word like that. But it means to be quiet and be still. Don't do anything. Just stop. Be still. Two words, actually. Be still and know that I am God. And the thing is, we can't really know God or know about God or know that he is God unless we stop and be silent and be still. The two ideas are inseparably linked. I will be exalted among the nations, and I will be exalted among the earth. In the earth. We don't get that, brothers and sisters, unless we stop in silence in order to know. Psalm 55, verse 6. Actually, we need to start at verse 4 here. This is a Psalm of David, and David, when he's writing this, is really uptight. He's really got some serious issues. He says in verse 4, my heart is in anguish within me. The terrors of death assail me. Life was pressing down on him. He had no space. Fear and trembling had beset him. Horror has overwhelmed me, he says. And I said, oh, that I had the wings of a dove. I would fly away and be at rest. I would flee far away and stay in the desert. Get everybody out of my face. All of this stuff gone. I could sit in the middle of the desert, he said, and just be at peace and be silent so I could know my God. I would hurry to my place of shelter far from the tempest and storm. And really, brothers and sisters, that place of shelter for us isn't necessarily in the middle of the desert, although it well could be, and it might be a wonderful place to be at times. It's really in our heart, the silence and the rest and the peace in our heart. And why would David say this, of course? Because in verse 22, he says he could cast his cares upon the Lord and be sustained by the Lord. That's the miracle in David's life. Because he knew that the Lord would never let the righteous fall. He could call to God and God would answer. But it wouldn't work unless he could be at rest and had the wings of a dove so he could fly away. Now, just recently, we've had a lot of birds in our backyard, but we've never seen any doves before. But there were two, a pair, a couple of doves showed up. Actually, not as peaceful as we might think, because they dominated all the rest of the birds, and they took over the perch on top of our pergola. There was a male and a female, because there was a big one and a little one. I suspect that's what it was. And they kind of sat there real close together, just pushing one another like that and cooing. And that's peaceful, restful. Anyway, that's a bit of a side. Psalm 37 and verse 7. Psalm 37 and verse 7. Be still before the Lord and wait patiently for him. And there's a couple of words there too. The word still is there. And wait is there. Patiently. Sometimes we're impatient about the Lord's will in our life. But we have to be still. We have to be quiet. We have to be at rest. We have to be silent before that will happen to us. Do not fret when men succeed in their ways. That's what we do a lot of, isn't it? Well, again, maybe I'm just talking to myself. But the fretting is part of the state of our heart that excludes the silence. Oh, and he goes on to say that in verse 9, evil men will be cut off, but those who hope in the Lord will inherit the land. And as Jesus said, you know, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall inherit the earth. So it's ingrained in our understanding of God and our relationship. Be still and wait patiently. Psalm 4, verse 4. And Jesus, of course, refers to this in the Gospels. In your anger, do not sin. Well, I like to think that means I don't necessarily have to not be angry, but just not sin. When you are on your beds, search your hearts and be silent. Be silent. Search your hearts. So there's a couple more words there, the searching and the silence. We have to be quiet in order to really search our hearts, to really see what's there. Oh, and three dramatic examples from the king's record. But let's start in 1 Samuel chapter 12. One of the great blessings of doing the readings, we get to go through these accounts. And Samuel was ticked off, really, because the people wanted a king. And they were quite adamant about this. They were going to have a king. And Samuel knew that wasn't a good thing for the people. And the people thought it was the best thing because that's what the other nations around them had. And there was this event going on with the people challenging Samuel. And Samuel saying, no, this is not a good thing for you. And I know we got all these enemies around you. In verse 12, the Ammonites, and you've got the Philistines, and you've got the people from Moab, and you've got all those people that are kind of coming down on you, and you're in this sort of anguish, and you think that this king's going to do it. And there was a lot of clamor and chatter going on about what was going to happen. And Samuel said, Now, just, okay, stand still, verse 16. And see this great thing the Lord is about to do for you. Be quiet, he said. Be silent. The Lord is going to show you how he's going to take care of this thing and how he's prepared to do something for you, even though you've rejected him. And so Samuel calls to the Lord, and he brings thunder, just immediate, massive thunder. So much so that in verse 19, the people said to Samuel, pray to the Lord your God for your servants so that we will not die, for we have added to all our other sins the evil of asking for a king. But before they could come to that moment to hear the thunder, the voice of God speaking to them, and to understand and reflect upon how things were going in their life, they had to be quiet and to be still. Well, Elijah, you know, in 1 Kings, and let's just go over to 1 Kings 19. He'd had a lot of stuff going on in his life, too. Challenging those prophets of Baal up in Horeb and dispatching 300 or 400 of them. That kind of freaked out, because it turns out that Jezebel had put out a contract on him when he was heading back to Jezreel. So he flees down into the wilderness, into the south. And we know the story. He ends up finally in Horeb. And verse 11, the Lord said, go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by. And a great and powerful wind tore the mountain apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord, but the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake came a fire, and the Lord wasn't in the fire. And Elijah liked all that stuff. You know, he'd been working with that most of his prophetical career. And after the fire came a gentle whisper. Elijah heard it. He pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood in the mouth of the cave. And was at that moment ready to listen to what the Lord had to say when he was quiet. 2 Kings 6 and 16. This is a little more dramatic even in terms of the miracle. Elisha had trapped some Armenians, Syrians actually, from the north. And they trapped them in this little town. And, well, actually, the king of Syria, there's some intelligence problems. And every time they went out to war, the Israelites seemed to know where they were, so somebody said, well, it's not one of us that's betraying the army. It's this prophet, Elisha, in Israel. Verse 12, he tells the king of Israel the very words you speak in your bedroom. And the king of Assyria says, go find him. So they go to Dothan because a report was there. And the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning. An army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city, the Armenian army. And he gets into a panic. Oh, my Lord, he says, what shall we do? And Elisha said, don't be afraid. Be quiet. Be silent. Those who are with us are more than those with them. Now, that sounds like a rational proposition, but Elisha's servant wasn't too sure. Elisha prayed, oh Lord, open his eyes so he can see. And the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And so, brothers and sisters, what we're saying is that he couldn't see it until he went into that moment of being still. And the thing is that the horses and chariots of the Lord are there today for us. That's the miracle in our lives. We just don't see it. And I'm not saying that if we find this silence and this rest in our lives that we will have that type of vision. I don't want you to think I'm saying that. But I think we need to understand that unless we reach that stage of rest and peace and silence in our life, we have no hope in any case of seeing it. Elihu, when he was talking to Job, he said in verse 14 of Job 37, he said, stop and consider God's wonders. You can't consider God's wonders unless you stop, be silent, be quiet. Then you can consider it. That most important of all verses in Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 20, where Habakkuk says, the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silent before him. Jesus, on a number of occasions in the Gospels, went up into the mountain to pray. Philippians chapter 2, verse 8 said that Jesus emptied himself and humbled himself. Peter in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 14 said, be spotless, blameless, and at peace with him. It's the same idea being expressed in all of these verses. Perhaps the most momentous example of this is in Deuteronomy chapter 14. So perhaps you could turn back with me to Deuteronomy 14. These are great accounts for us to parallel our lives with, to sort of go in and think about it. Apart from the fact that the Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had been given a name, and that name appears a number of times in this 14th chapter of Exodus, and what that name means essentially is I will. Whatever we want to do with the Hebrew of it, it means I will. And that shows up in verse 4 when it says, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. Verse 4 again, at the end of the verse, I am the Lord. So the Israelites go out from Egypt. And they, at that point in time, because they had decided that this was a thing to do and that they had the Lord on their side, it says in my NIV in verse 8, who were, that is Israel, marching out boldly. And shortly after, they find out that the Egyptians now had got their army together and were following them out into the desert. And so from marching out boldly in verse 8 to verse 10, where it said they were terrified when they found the Egyptians were marching after them, and they cried to the Lord. And they made a whole bunch of incredible statements, as we often do in those kind of situations. And they said, aren't there enough graves in Egypt? The government in Egypt, I think, had expropriated 60 or 70% of the entire landmass of Egypt for graves. And, of course, we can see the events and the result of that even today, thousands of years later. It was a bit of real good sarcasm. There were lots of grave sites in Egypt. He brought us out to die in this desert. Didn't we say to you in Egypt, leave us alone? It would have been better if we'd have just stayed there and served the Egyptians. In verse 13, Moses answered the people and said, do not be afraid, stand firm. You will see the deliverance of the Lord that he will bring on you today. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. Be quiet. The Lord will take care of this. So go back, he says to Moses, and say to the Israelites, what are you crying to me for? Don't do it anymore. Just move on. Verse 15. And of course, we know the end of the story. It reminds me, too, of an account I heard once of a little boy who'd been to Sunday school. And after Sunday school, his dad said, so what did you learn at Sunday school today? He said, oh, we learned about the Israelites. And well, what were the Israelites doing? Well, they were leaving Egypt, and they were all marching out of Egypt, and they're all happy because they'd been slaves in Egypt, and they're marching out. And well, what happened? His dad said, well, then the Egyptian army started to chase them, and they went out into the desert. And well, what happened then? He said, well, the Egyptian army trapped them against this sea, and they couldn't move, and they were all afraid. And his dad said, well, what happened then? He said, well, the Israeli Air Force came over and bombed and strafed the Egyptian army. And the Israeli Navy went and got a whole bunch of big pontoons and hooked them together and made a bridge across the sea, and the Israelites went across. And then the Air Force blew up the pontoons, and the Egyptians couldn't get across to get them. His dad says, no, that's not what happened. He says, oh, I know, Dad, but if I told my friends what they taught me at Sunday school, he said, nobody would believe me. And that's another problem we have, isn't it? When we get a miracle, we want to rationalize it. We want to say it's something else. We don't want to say it's a miracle from the Lord. We need to stand still and let the Lord fight for us. We need to remember, brothers and sisters, and understand that God in our lives will make a way when there appears to be no way. We need to understand, brothers and sisters, that when the demons and terrors of our lives descend upon us and trap us, that God will take us to the other side. We will walk on dry land, even though our enemies will perish in the sea. We often have this fundamental resistance to standing still and being quiet and being silent and letting go so that we can let God take over our lives. Before the miracle can happen in our life, before we can know God, we've got to find some time for silence. We've got to shut up. Because if we don't, there will be no miracle. There will be no miracle in our lives without being still. God will not fill our hearts with his blessings if they're already full of other things. God will not fill our hearts with his Spirit, as we read in Romans chapter 8 this morning, if they're already full of the busy noise and clatter of other things. God will not speak to our ears if they are already stopped from the interference of all this noisy clanging of the world. Our redemption, brothers and sisters, will be found in being still and knowing God. Our salvation will be in resting from our noise and chatter and being with God. Our salvation will be in patient, quiet, silent waiting for the voice and message of God. Our eternity will be realized in the miracles that will flow in our lives from emptying ourselves and letting the Lord's Spirit indwell and direct us, the blessed sound of silence. This is what we've come, of course, to remember today and reflect upon the sacrifice of the perfect life, where the sin in the flesh was silent, was sacrificed for us and for the Father. And this reality, brothers and sisters, as we partake of this bread and wine, must become the blessing of this place, the serenity of this place at this moment as we share these emblems, to lead us on throughout the day and through the coming week to find rest and peace and silence before him.